Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today and tomorrow mark the sesquicentennial of the turning point of the U.S. Civil War, with the Battle of Gettysburg concluding today on this date and the fall of Vicksburg on July 4th. My guests today ask a broader question. Why did we fight this most costly war in American history? Well, the simple answer is slavery. But again, why did we fight a war that cost upwards of a million lives when the rest of Europe, the slave-owning parts of the Western Hemisphere, freed their slaves without major violence? Historian Thomas Fleming was struck by a phrase of the time, a disease of the public mind, which describes the northern-southern divides. In his book of the same name, he traces how early Americans began to differ on the view of slavery, and as well as the economic divisions and political jealousies which drove a wedge between North and South. While the history we learn doesn't mention slavery as a national issue until the 19th century, Fleming writes in his book that it was an issue from the beginning days of the colonial days in the Constitution and the Revolutionary War. Historian Thomas Fleming is the author of numerous books of history, including The Intimate Lives of the Founding Fathers, Washington's Secret War, and Duel. He's been a frequent guest on documentaries and historical programs on PBS, A&E, and the History Channel. His new book is titled, "A Disease in the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War." He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Thomas Fleming, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, I'm delighted to be with you, Rich.
Your title refers to a quote that you first saw from President Buchanan, James Buchanan, yeah, as he was getting ready to leave office at the point that the Civil War was on the horizon. I mean, it was in the windshield, if you will.
Exactly, yeah.
And he referred to the John Brown raid, which you lead the book off with,
yes,
as an incurable disease in the public mind. And you
right.
said, and she said, I wanted to focus on that idea of the public mind. What did you mean by that?
Well, I had to find out what Buchanan meant. It's that the phrase is not used very often anymore, but it was once in the 19th century and the 18th century. You know, Washington used it constantly. Jefferson used it. Lincoln used it. The public mind is a set of beliefs. It's how people view the realities of their time. And sometimes they're accurate, you know, they know exactly what's going on. But a lot of it, when it becomes a disease in the public mind, then this is what President Buchanan meant, they have a distorted view of reality. And that leads to trouble, there's no doubt about it. Very often, there's a lot of anger and prejudice involved in these distorted views. Alexander Hamilton had a great quote along the same line. He said, people tend to follow their prejudices and passions, he said, instead of thinking intelligently about what's really happening in front of their eyes.
Now, the question I had about that particular quote, though, was he was referring to John Brown's raid, which was taking up violence to end slavery, as opposed to the Civil War, which was violence in the hopes of perpetuating it, or, you know, secession and violence.
Well, on both sides, it was, yeah, you know, violence to perpetuate and violence to eliminate it, too, at the same time. That was the clash, that these two diseases, the northern disease of which involved hatred of Southerners. It isn't about slavery. The disease of the public mind in the North was hatred of Southerners because they believed that slavery was a sin. And in the South, the distorted disease or distorted fear was the fear of a race war. They were afraid in many counties of the South, almost half the counties of the South, blacks outnumbered whites. And they could not buy this. The Southerners refused to accept this idea that the South should free all its slaves just like that. You know, the abolitionists were calling for immediate emancipation.
You know, we think of slavery as driving a wedge between the states, say, after the dawn of the 19th century, really. And we think of the Missouri Compromise and all of the acts of Congress basically trying to postpone this day that would have happened in 1861. But what your book does is says, you know, these divides were a part of our country before we were a country, while we were still a colony. The seeds were in this divide was already there.
No doubt about it. Right after the Revolution, Alexander Hamilton wrote a letter to the governor of New York saying, if I were you, I'd give free land to a lot of the veterans of the Continental Army. We could use some soldiers because I think we're going to have a civil war before a few more years go by. This is in 1781. So these 13 colonies didn't get along that well. They really didn't. Particularly the Northerners, the New Englanders, had a sort of superior moral attitude towards the rest of the country. They saw themselves as the anointed children of God and so forth. And the potential for animosity was there. There's no doubt about it. And the New Englanders actually started talking about seceding from the country very early in the game.
Well, we'll talk about that idea of northern secession, which was another idea in this book that I'd not heard of before. But let's begin with some of the early characters that you profile. One was John Woolman, who was a New Jersey Quaker, who was asked to sign a bill of sale on the transfer of a slave when he has this epiphany that this was morally wrong. And this is what year is this, about 16-something?
This was 1750.
1750.
Yes. So, we're still 25 years away from the American Revolution, and he was from New Jersey, and he was a very religious man, like most Quakers, and he was a clerk in a dry goods store, and the owner said, could you sign this, make out this bill of sale? I'm selling Nancy, who was a servant in the house. And Woolman just suddenly, his hand froze. He couldn't bring himself to do this, and then he managed to do it with great effort. And he got it done, but he never did another thing like that, and he realized that he felt slavery was very definitely wrong in some profound way. And he started to travel around the country, and he went to Philadelphia, where the sort of headquarters of the Quakers in America, and he spoke to them there, and he became, in his own quiet way, a crusader. He took trips to the South and talked to them down there, saying, would you ever consider freeing your slaves? And he actually did persuade some people to do it, but not very many. Most of them got very angry. So he had an ongoing, quiet crusade, as I say, against slavery. And then he went to England, because they were a British possession. And only thought, well, I'll go to the headquarters of the whole empire and see what I can do over there. And by this time, he only wore white clothes. He wouldn't use clothes that were dyed with indigo, which was raised by slave labor in the West Indies. And so he looked pretty strange. And he went to this meeting of Quakers in London. The Quakers in London were a very rich group. And this prominent physician took one look at this weirdo from America in this all-white outfit. And he said, there's no need for Mr. Woolman to tell us why he's here. So let him just put his request in writing, and then he should go home as soon as possible. I mean, talk about a bad reception. But Woolman, he was a truly religious guy. He didn't get angry or anything. He just quietly told how he's had these visits from God, telling him that slavery was wrong and so forth. And after he sat down after a half hour, and the doctor rose and said, I would like to apologize to you, Mr. Woolman.
Yeah, and apparently this is the beginning of the Quaker movement for abolition.
Yes, they were the pioneers of trying to get America to free the slaves. However, in America, they shot themselves in the foot during the American Revolution, and so they were not effective at all after the Revolution ended. During the Revolution, the Quakers decided they couldn't support the Americans. They were against war in all ways, shape, and form. And by this time, they were among the wealthiest people in Philadelphia, and they wouldn't pay any taxes. So quite a group of them got arrested and sent to Western Virginia, and they were treated very, very badly. Their windows were smashed. They were beaten up on the street by people. And their effectiveness as a spokesperson for anti-slavery in America was fatally damaged by this. In England, on the other hand, they were among the pioneers who persuaded the British first to end the slave trade, and then in 1834, they persuaded some very prominent politicians to go along with them, in 1834, the British ended slavery in the West Indies. 850,000 slaves were freed peacefully. Well, I think there was maybe a little uproar on Jamaica, but it was a feat that you could trace back to John Woolman. It took another 70 years after he died. He died in England of smallpox.
Yeah, it's interesting that you write early in the book, of all the Western powers that had slaves, slaves had been around for millennia.
Yeah,
And all of a sudden, in the 19th century, all of these countries basically give up the idea of slavery. Even later, Russia would give up the idea of peasantry and
right, the serfs, as they call them.
Serfs, yeah. But here in America, we fought a war, and our most terrible war ever.
More people died in the Civil War, more young men died in the Civil War than in all our other wars combined.
My guest today is historian Thomas Fleming. His new book is titled A Disease in the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War. It's published by DeCapo Press. And in it, he begins with John Brown's raid, but then he goes back through history, beginning with John Woolman, this Quaker who sort of started the abolition movement, if you want to say that.
Peaceful abolition movement.
Yes, peaceful, yeah. And then from then, just tell some very interesting stories about American history. And another person you write about is Colonel John Lawrence. Now, Lawrence died at the waning days of the Revolutionary War. Most of the major battles, it was just skirmish.
But
he was very close aide to Washington. And you tell another story that most people wouldn't know, that at one point in the Revolution, one out of every seven American Revolutionary soldiers were black.
Yes, and this is a great tribute to Washington, Rich. You know, he listened to these guys when he first took command of the army in 1775, and a lot of them had fought at the Battle of Bunker Hill, about which I'd written a book, and they convinced them that they could be good soldiers. And so even though some Southern congressmen said, oh, we don't like this, and so forth, he let them in the army. And more and more joined as the war went on. A whole regiment of black men joined from Rhode Island, and by 1781, one out of every seven soldiers in the ranks was black.
In the late 1770s, the British switched the war from the mid-Atlantic coast down to the South.
Yeah.
This is where John Lawrence comes in, because he says, look, we have more black slaves than we do white people in South Carolina. Let's create a brigade. And this goes, you know, it doesn't go anywhere in South Carolina, because as you write, the great fear in many parts of the South, and South Carolina was perhaps more salient, was they were absolutely fear of armed slaves and a possible slave revolt.
Right. And so this was very radical. And he wanted to free 3,000 men, 3,000 black men, and put them in the army as regular soldiers, you know. And this was an incredibly daring thing. And the interesting thing, too, Rich, is that Washington agreed with it. He went along with it. He was a Southerner, but he went along with this, because he'd already seen that black soldiers were very effective fighters in the ranks of the army as it was already constituted. So he sent Lawrence down, or he let Lawrence go down to South Carolina to try to sell the idea to the South Carolina legislature. And that's where the tragedy began to build up. Lawrence was such an idealistic guy. But the interesting thing, too, is that he had a very close friend, Alexander Hamilton, who was also one of Washington's aides. And Hamilton went to the president of the Continental Congress, and he told him what Lawrence's plan was. And the president, whose name was John Jay, he was from New York, he liked it so much that he persuaded Congress to pass a bill saying that they would pay the owners for compensation to free these slaves. And one of the members of Congress said, if this passes, this could lead to the abolition of slavery in America. And that statement by the congressman has led many people to say that this was really the first, this bill that Congress passed could recall the first Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah.
And so there was a huge potential here, you know. But the South Carolina legislature, as you've already said, were so afraid of armed slaves that they just wouldn't listen to Lawrence. So he decided he was going to do some really daring things on the battlefield. Even though the war was over, there was still skirmishing going on all around South Carolina. The war was almost over, you know, and so anyway, he started to do some daring things. He was a very daring soldier, and he finally led a charge against about 150 entrenched British, and they blasted him and his men. He went down with a bullet in his heart, and that was the end of the first Emancipation Proclamation.
And you also, you made a point that this was a long simmering problem. You mentioned the first Emancipation Proclamation. One of the real worries, even during the Revolutionary War, in the years after the Revolutionary War, was if not outright secession, a state coming to accords with Great Britain to preserve slavery.
Oh, yes, yes. That was South Carolina. At one point, this was toward the end of the war, a British army marched up from Georgia, and they were going to attack Charleston. And the governor of the American governor of South Carolina, and an elected official, he tried to get Lawrence to negotiate with the British, and say, if you agree that you won't fool around with our slaves, you won't try to free them or anything like that, we'll drop out of the war. And Lawrence was infuriated and told the governor off in no gentle terms, you know, that he wouldn't say such a thing to a British officer. And so the governor backed down, but it just showed what they were thinking.
Now, earlier you mentioned George Washington, how he, as a Southerner, he came to accept the African-American soldiers in the Continental Army.
Yeah.
But one of the things you write is that led to a real evolution on his part on slavery, you believe, in your writings. You say, you know, this shows an evolution on the case of George Washington and how he began to think of his slaves. And, of course, he freed them on his death.
Yeah, he got part of this idea came not only from his experience with these black soldiers, but also the Marquis de Lafayette, the French volunteer. He told Washington he was shocked that the Americans weren't abolishing slavery along with winning their independence. And Washington started to think very hard about slavery. And the next thing you know, he refused to sell any slave who was married. You know, he regarded slave marriages as sacred. He wouldn't sell a husband or a wife under any circumstances. And he appointed black men as overseers of some of his farms at Mount Vernon. And they did. If they did a good job, he gave them rewards. He even allowed slaves to go out on the river and fish. He gave them boats. And he gave a couple of others that he trusted guns to go hunting to supplement their diets. He really started to treat them like people. And like white people. And the climax of this whole thing was after he left the presidency. Well, let's go back just a moment. While he was president, he twice thought about freeing all the slaves at Mount Vernon, all the ones he owned, but Martha owned quite a few too, all the slaves at Mount Vernon, and calling on other Americans to imitate his example. This would have had a huge impact on the country. But meanwhile, there was a tremendous argument swirling through the country about the French Revolution, and some Americans thought we should get involved in it and go to war with the British, and Washington insisted that we should remain neutral. And so the argument was so alarming to Washington, he was afraid by if he added slavery, freeing the slaves, to the whole menu of political problems, that the Union would just collapse. And the Union was his crucial achievement. That's what he saw. So he didn't do anything while he was president. But after he left the presidency, he wrote a will in his own hand, and he freed all his slaves on his death. And the interesting thing, too, in that will, Rich, is he specified each of these slaves should be taught to read and write and be given a skill, trained in a skill so they could make a decent living. It's a fascinating document, that Washington's will. It shows how he had come to respect slaves as individuals, and it's very impressive. Unfortunately, the shock of his death was so stupendous. You know, this guy had been the father of the country, literally, in so many ways, for 30 years, and all of a sudden he got sick in the morning and he died that night. And the shock was so stupendous that him freeing these slaves was just not noticed. Instead, the country was awash in grief and anxiety and so forth and so forth. And that's why I call, in the book, I call Washington the forgotten emancipator.
Yeah. Now, Washington was present at the Constitutional Convention. Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, which you include a section of an early draft that was quickly deleted by the Southern members,
yes.
Which likened King George III. It was kind of like the Americans were the kids that ate the cookies and blamed the mother for making the cookies so they could
right,
eat it. You know,
right.
it was very
That's
it was kind
very
of a
good metaphor.
It was a very petulant argument, and I think probably, although it was very anti-slavery, and it's a sad fact that it isn't in the Declaration of Independence, the logic was a little off, I'd say.
Yes, I agree with you. Yes, but it's a political document. You know, when people write political documents, they tend to go for the broadest possible term. You know.
But in both of those documents, slavery was a part of the discussion, but it doesn't really end up in the document because it was a deal killer in both cases, wasn't it?
Yes, especially the Declaration of Independence. They as you say, the Southern congressmen just didn't see it, didn't want it in there. But the Northerners were very uneasy about it, too, because a lot of their ships were active in the slave trade, bringing the blacks from Africa. So there wasn't much argument about deleting this stuff from the continent, from the Declaration of Independence. Now, in the Constitutional Convention, as the document began to evolve and people saw that Washington, who had a lot to do with talking to Madison about what he wanted and all that, they were creating a very strong federal government. And the Southerners suddenly started saying, uh-oh, these people will have the power to tell the states what to do about an awful lot of things. And we are a little uneasy about what they might start telling us to do about slavery. So some Southerners stood up and said, we want to guarantee that slavery will be accepted in this new country. Otherwise, we're out of here. They were going to just walk out and form a separate country, South Carolina, Georgia, probably North Carolina.
Yeah.
And so that was a threat again. And Washington, with that determination to preserve the Union, that was his great value. He made sure that the convention accepted this that the slavery would be tolerated. But they did get the Southerners to not count each slave as a person. The Southerners agreed to count each slave as 3/5 of a person.
Yes.
When they were deciding how many representatives they'd have in the House of Representatives.
One of the few stains on that document. That's one of the few stains on that document, I would have to say. Counting slaves.
Yes, it is a stain. But they see, at this point, we have to sort of yank ourselves out of our mindset. We think of slavery as a horrible institution and so forth, and there's no doubt that we're right now, but people didn't think that way in those days. Slavery had been around for 2,000 years and had been in this country since 1619, and they didn't create slavery, these guys, but they had all these slaves, and they wanted to be able to deal with them as they saw fit and not have somebody start telling them what to do about it. And so if we go back to that mindset and see that Washington and the others were willing to settle because the Union was at stake here. And I think if you pause for a moment and think of what might have happened if the Union had collapsed and the country broke up, we'd be another Europe today. There would be countries, you know, Massachusetts and Connecticut, and maybe New Hampshire would be a country, and they'd be fighting wars with the New York and New Jersey, and it would have been a terrible, terrible tragedy to lose this union of all these states.
Now, earlier you alluded to Northern secession. Now, we know about the Civil War and the secession that caused that. We also know about a nullification in the 1830s, I think, when Andrew Jackson stood up to Calhoun in South Carolina then.
Right.
But there was an effort about the time of the War of 1812 when some of the northern states were considering secession. How serious was this? How serious was it?
Very serious. The New Englanders by this time had developed a terrific animosity to the South and to Southern presidents. Jefferson had triggered this animosity with to keep us out of the war with England and France. He announced there would be an embargo on all trade, and it bankrupted thousands of merchants in New England, and there were 40,000 sailors rioting in the ports. It really turned New England off the South forever. And so when the War of 1812 began a few years later, they did everything they could to sort of hamstring the federal government, and they kept condemning the war and urging them to make peace. The president, James Madison of Virginia, of course, to make peace and so forth and so forth. And when they didn't get anywhere, the next thing you know, somebody was calling for a convention to meet in Hartford, Connecticut, where they would discuss certain things they wanted or they were going to secede.
Wow!
And they met. And they seriously they drew up a set of demands, and they sent 3 representatives down to Washington D.C. to talk to Madison and the members of Congress. They were that close to, and of course at the bottom line of these demands was, if we don't get them all, we're out of here. That's all there is to it. And this is it's very pretty much forgotten, and the day that these guys arrived in Washington, D.C. to lower this boom on poor President Madison, that very day, news arrived from the South that Andrew Jackson had won this stupendous victory over a British army in New Orleans. And suddenly, there were people were dancing in the streets, and Madison was a popular president again, and it looked like we were going to be able to settle the war on our terms and not the British terms, et cetera, et cetera. And these three representatives from the Hartford Convention, they slunk out of town.
Well, this is
So that's how that crisis ended. But it didn't remove the North's, the New England's hostility to the South. They continue to do things to make life uncomfortable for Southerners.
You know, and what this book points out is, you know, we talk about our rhetoric today and where compromise is a dirty word. That's been the course throughout our history, but we should be careful about that, shouldn't we?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is this whole book is, in a way, an example of the no-compromise mentality, which became part of the public mind of both the North in one way and in the South in another way. And the result was a million young men died. And so there's a lesson to be learned here that compromise is not a dirty word. It can save immense amounts of pain and suffering.
Well, as we speak today, we are at the 150th anniversary of really the turning point of the Civil War.
Yes,
Gettysburg. And at Vicksburg as well, I think.
And Vicksburg, too, sure.
Yes,
yeah.
It fell on July 4th. What should we keep in mind about this anniversary, about what it says about us as an American people?
I think that we have to honor the men who fought there as preservers of the Union. Some of them were fighting to free the slaves, but we have to honor the courage that they displayed on both sides. That's the thing. We Lincoln, at the end of the war, in his wonderful second inaugural address, you know, he said, maybe God has insisted that we go through this terrible suffering to end slavery. He said he wasn't sure, but maybe that's the way. But what we have to do above all now is to we should have malice toward none, forgiveness for all, and we have to become a one country again. This is the essential message that his great vision handed on to us. And it's tied into Washington's vision of a nation, as he called it, unstained by slavery, we talked about as in Gettysburg, in his great speech, Lincoln talked about a new birth of freedom, but when the war ended, he wanted to see this new birth of freedom combined with forgiveness on both sides, and forgiveness on the part of Black Americans too. Realizing that a million mostly white Americans had died to help free them. And so I think that there's a lot of lessons we can learn or ideas that we should cherish in our hearts, really. That's how I think of it, from reading this book and reliving these great battles.
The name of the book is A Disease in the Public Mind. Tom Fleming, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rich.
Historian Thomas Fleming speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled A Disease in the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War. It's published by DeCapo Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed any of our recent broadcasts, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.